GM, everybody, welcome to Flywheel, your number one source for everything, crypto, DeFi, and all that's in between. If you want to know what's going on in the world on chain, well, you've come to the right place. This is DeFi Dave, and I'm here to tell you how you can capture the power of the Flywheel. And in this episode, we have on Tarun of Gauntlet and Robot Ventures. We have on Chunda of Ion Protocol, who is a guest host with me. And the question I want to pose to the viewers and listeners of this is, what with EigenLayer and the Eigen token, what will make the Eigen token successful? What problems will the token and the protocol overall have to overcome? And yeah, this is that, those are the two main things. But before we get into it, make sure you go ahead and follow us on all our socials at Flywheel DeFi on Twitter, TikTok, Telegram. Go to our website, flywheeldefi.com. Subscribe for all our latest updates and podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at DeFiDave22. And let's get the Flywheel spinning. All right, everybody. Welcome back to Flywheel. I'm your host, DeFi Dave, and here with my guest co-host, Chunda. Thanks for joining us, Chunda. And this time around, I'm very excited to introduce Tarun, who is the founder of Gauntlet, which has been called the McKinsey of DeFi and crypto. And also, he's at Robot Ventures investing in things. Tarun, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, excited to be here.
Yeah. To get right into it, the big, you know, talk and topic of the week has been the Eigen token and the Eigen airdrop. You know, it's, you know, stoked a visceral reaction on Twitter, to say the least. But I want to go into the tokenomics itself. Have you read the white paper at all? Like, what do you think of it? Do you think it's sound? And do you think the strong reaction to it is valid or overblown?
Yeah, look, so I actually had read the paper before it came out, and just for giving feedback. And I think it describes the problem space very well. I think, like, you know, all the previous sort of writings on restaking sort of describe a high level description, but they don't kind of describe the problems that in some level of detail that need to be solved. Now, I think obviously there's a lot more that probably needs to be done, right? Like, I would say that there's not like full security proof in the paper. I think a lot of the forking stuff is still a little, like, there's a lot of details that need to be filled in. But all in all, I think it like lays out the problem well. I think,
what are the problems?
Well, I think, A, how do you think about this notion of attribution in decentralized systems? Like, you know, in order to penalize someone, I need to have a way that I can attribute that they made a fault in a way that, you know, like, it would take a supermajority to falsify that fault. So, like, you know, I can't get slashed for not doing some event that because everyone else hates me or something, right? Like, it has to be some notion of attribution. So I think when you think about these systems, you know, in the case of like very objectively attributable things, like, hey, 2/3 of the network agrees that you missed a slot, like you won a slot, you didn't send a block. Okay, you get slashed. That's like a very sort of more attributable thing because, A, it's time bounded. There's only a certain window of time in which everyone has to respond. And then B, it's like, hey, there was no block. Like, if there was, prove that you actually made it and that enough people had it, right? Like, part of the rules are that at least 2/3 had to have received it in that time window. So that's sort of like, you know, in proof of stake systems, an attributable fault. And I think, you know, all slashing that exists effectively only really can give you get formal guarantees when you have really attributable faults. You know, and I think obviously in something where, like EigenLayer, where the AVSs are potentially doing something that the base protocol cannot attribute for a bunch of different reasons, but let's take a simple example of one, which is, suppose that, you know, 1/3 of a proof of stake network validators, set of validators, are restaking and validating an AVS. Well, The AVS's rules might be two-thirds of who is restaked has to agree on an attribution for a fault for a reason to slash someone. But the two-thirds of the AVS stake is only two-ninths of the overall stake, right? It's two-thirds times one-third. Where, so in some sense, to the base layer, that's not sufficient to override something. And if the slashes are related or correlated in some way, you may be able to force one and not the other. And so one argument of how to get around that is to try to have other users who aren't validating be able to participate at least partially in this idea of like, when is there a fault? Can they say yes or no to whether there was a fault or not? Now, of course, this goes back far before EigenLayer. I think even in the earliest days of like Bitcoin prediction markets and then Augur and other things, you have this notion of resolving a market where people who aren't participating in the market have to have some say in it. But that, you know, how do you incentivize them to do that correctly, and how do you guarantee security properties? That's the hard part. And I think, you know, that's the part that they describe the problem of, and they describe how the token allows for forking, but they don't give like a security proof that I would say is full. And it's not necessarily in my mind that I think that proof, as you can see from like multiple, a decade of prediction market research, it's actually extremely hard to have. So there's in some sense a big relation between how they're doing I know there's a fancy word, which is like intersubjective work.
Intersubjective, that's the word that's on Twitter. Yeah. Is Eigen a prediction market token? Is that like another way to think of it?
There's a sense in which it is a prediction market on like choosing a fork, right? Like if you, and that's where a lot of the overlap comes in. I think I think there's work on, you know, I prefer thinking of it instead of in terms of, you know, so the way the name comes from, right, is like I was talking about slashings that are attributable, right? Attributable meaning like, hey, you didn't send a block, two-thirds of people say you didn't send a block, we're slashing you, right? That's like a pretty clean one, right? Mm-hmm. Well, another word for attributable is objective. Like it's like there's something that two-thirds of people can measure and tell you yes or no. And if you majority vote them and they say no, then like you slash, right? So the intersubjective is supposed to be like it's the opposite of objective, but it's subjectivity across multiple groups, right? Of course, you know, crypto Twitter has no notion of nuance, so no one bothered trying to understand where the word came from. They just were like, you know, making fun of it, you know. I remember, like,
where did the word come from?
Smoky, making fun of the etymologists in the basement at EigenLayer or whatever. I saw that tweet.
Those are the real cooks in that basement.
Yeah, I think people. I mean, the word comes from what I just said, which is like normal, yeah. Like slashing that you can do for sure is this like notion of objective slashing.
Objective, yeah,
and subjective is the opposite. The intersubjective is like there's multiple groups, like different groups of validators who have to come to this agreement. So it's like you have this subjectivity between these different groups. So that's sort of the correct etymology. I do think it's like kind of a word that trips people up. I prefer thinking of it as like in the same way that in data availability sampling, like in that you have in Celestia, or EigenDA or anything that will be using that. All of those systems work by having light clients, so clients who aren't validating every block, but clients who might be submitting transactions or reading some chain state, but not the whole thing, and validating small pieces of it. They can participate by giving you like statistical proofs of parts of random parts of the blockchain in some sense. And given sufficiently many of them, the probability that they're all lying or all wrong is so low that you know there must have been a fault. So it's a way of getting people who aren't main chain participants, like validators, to be able to contribute to some part of consensus, but not full consensus. And the idea for something like DA is, well, DA is a time-bounded thing, right? There's a time you need to be able to make the dispute. So perhaps you can have enough of these light client participating. So this means like you, when you open your wallet, Argent wallet might, or Rainbow wallet might say, hey, can you validate that this data looks correct? And if it's correct, you'll get some tiny reward. And if enough people do that, that's a very like kind of oversimplified mm-hmm. version of how data availability sampling works. So you could think in the long shot of like other AVSs sort of want to have this same type of thing where light clients can participate on like partial reconstruction. And if enough of them don't disagree, then you know something went wrong. Whereas like enough of them agree, you know something was right. So I think one way of thinking about the token in a more simplified version of it, without the whole inflation, deflation, and B eigen, normal eigen thing, is it's just a way for light clients to participate in the validation in the worst case event that something goes wrong, without the light clients having to know the entire history and state. So they can like say something is wrong now with high probability without having to know like every possible transaction that's gone through. So I think enhanced light client participation is what I would call it personally. That's like how I thought of it when reading the paper, because it is a way to do data availability sampling for things that aren't data availability, for all these other things AVSs do. And I think if people spent a little time instead of getting mad and read about it, like you would see that's kind of what the core Cohen of it is, right? Which is like, how do you get light clients to participate in certain events in consensus without overloading them, right? Because like this idea that you want to like have the small set of validators do everything forever for all services is like impossible, right? That's like that's like me asking my friend who owns 100 computers if he wants to like compete with Amazon Web Services with his 100 computers, right? It's like, I don't know. It's not happening. Yeah. But you can do something where it's like, well, the guy with 100 web services does stuff, but he has to do some type of cryptographic proof and has to put up some collateral such that if all his users say he fucked them and didn't like give them the service, then like enough users agree, then like there's a way for them to participate in slashing it. And I think is the key thing that like needs to be kind of differentiated in my mind. And I think obviously there's a lot of work on clarity of that message that has to be done.
I'm curious here. I think one of the biggest other questions about the paper is not only like, cause once you understand the function of eigen, it's a very interesting concept. I think there are some people who have crossed that threshold. I think another large question that then immediately arrives to people is, which was kind of justified a little bit in the paper, but I'm curious, like your view on it in particular, is why do we have to create another asset to represent this? Why can't we use pre-existing assets that exist in the marketplace, whether it's ETH or restaked ETH or, you know, any other arbitrary asset, if we're actually going to create a new asset for it? Why not just use something that already exists? Why not just create a segmented market that internalizes this kind of like fork risk, separated from the original kind of like restaking market? Curious, like your view there.
Yeah, so one justification, and this is one of the types of things I think if you follow sort of like, if you follow some of the arguments that have existed in the past between Celestia and other DA layers, is that, you know, people will be like, oh, why does Celestia need its own chain for doing a DA, right? Well, there's some argument to be made, and it's sort of a very nuanced argument, so I'm going to try to sketch out the high level version of it, which is, suppose you have a main chain where you actually have some censorship issue. So some validator is able to censor you sending your blob or sending some piece of data to your main chain. And now, on the other hand, consider a chain where a separate chain that is supposed to be replicating some of that data, like a DA layer. There's some argument that like by having the separate token, you can slash the DA as a separate DA layer of validators for not including something in the main chain. So it acts as this kind of like second layer of defense against censorship. So there's sort of this implicit idea that DA layers can slash validators who don't include things that are in this other chain. Now, again, this boils down to the same intersubjectivity, for lack of a better word, because you need these two validator sets to agree on this thing, and there could be a fork in both of them at the same time, so they don't agree, right? I would argue that the Celestia argument for why, you know, a DA as its own chain makes sense is like kind of similar to this, which is it acts as a second line of defense to the main asset not like having some lack of censorship property. It like enhances censorship resistance, depending on how you want to look at it. Now, the problem with this entire argument is it actually depends very much on the economic payouts to the validators. Like the relative payouts, like are they making enough money to give a shit about being slashed on the DA? Maybe not, right? Maybe the rewards aren't worth it, so they don't care about getting slashed. And then the second thing is like how much do the validator sets overlap? Like if they're, you know, if they overlap a lot, it's a very different thing than if they're disjoint and dot dot dot. So my point is like there is an argument for it. It's very similar to the argument for why Celestia and Avail want their own chain, except, again, I think you have to remember in the Eigen case, because restaking means you have to support many different applications other than DA, you effectively need to build all these things that you have around these DA services, like data availability, sampling, and like clients' participation, like this ability of like some extra protection for censorship against slashing. You could argue that it's covering that. Now, you know, I think there's two versions of the world, right? Like if we're looking at the world now, like, you know, no matter what happens from the airdrop, like maybe the airdrop's not successful, maybe it does really well, whatever. The idea of reusing stake for these services is not going away. And, yeah, you know, you can always feel sad for Polkadot because they kind of came up with the idea first, but got
it too early.
Many such cases.
The problem is like, the problem is sometimes people in crypto think there's like, if you build it, they will come, is like, they believe that statement too much. You know what I mean? Yeah. Sometimes you just have to have demand first, then build things, as opposed to the other way around. But, I think like, this kind of model is not going away, and you're seeing all the DA layers, seeing Celestia, you're seeing Avail, etc. Like adding in restaking, or like there's Snark accounts in Celestia, which are like going to be allowing you to do ZK stuff, which allows you to do more than just DA in a lot of ways. And so basically, and so just for to give some provenance as to why that is, you know, obviously, all of these DA layers are doing some form of storage, right? They're storing some data that, you know, needs to be challenged, that needs to be used if there's a challenge later, in their blob space. Now, the part where they differ from storage is they have to be aware of this execution of this challenge for when there was fraud, so they can evict or, you know, be used in restarting the state of a chain. Now the problem is that it implicitly builds in some constraints from the rollup. So it's like, hey, the rollup virtual machine sent me a valid thing. Okay, I have to like evict to this blob or something like that. The problem is you can't express arbitrary constraints, right? Like in the eigenlayer world, you have a eigenpod. You can write, they have all these smart contracts and they're SDK for you writing like whatever you want. But in the Celestia world V1, right, it doesn't have a full virtual machine. It has a small programming model, which makes it a lot easier to reason about the security of. So there's a lot of benefit for that. But it also means it's hard to write new code. So them having ZK accounts means that, hey, look, I can validate a ZKP that someone computed something else that is not on my chain that says, hey, this is a valid fraud proof or this constraint is invalid. So like do whatever. So in some sense, like Celestia is going to have restaking in many at least that form, but probably in other forms. Avail is going to have it. Like, I think like there's a sense in which it's a thing that's definitely going to be there. And I do think all of these people will still have the same forking problem, because I think the DA forking thing is a kind of nice, yeah, very nice, idealistic type of forking, right? It's like I have a fixed window, can't really fork outside of that window, so I only need to be like ready for it in this small amount of time. But that's not going to be true for all AVSs. They're not going to be kind of this like very fixed thing.
It actually sounds like they're converging. You know, EigenLayer, you know, EigenDAs, like their first AVS, and then Hasfree staking, DA, EigenDA, obviously DA layer. And then you're saying that these DA layers like Celestia, like Avail, they're going to have for staking. They're all like 100%. Converging on this one.
Yeah. I think the model is like everyone knows that like that is the thing, right? So it's, I don't think there's a question that that's the market is going to go that way. I think, yeah, you know, obviously I think maybe there's, you know, I think despite the Twitter hating and doing all this stuff, I think you have to understand that like realistically what EigenLayer trying to do is basically say like, how do you take all this stuff from data availability sampling and make it work for things that aren't data availability? And there's all the other people are going to have to do the same thing too, right? Like, and it's the same set of problems. And that's what I thought the introduction to the paper really elucidates, that this is this problem that is like the generalized sort of data availability style challenge problem. And I think,
Go ahead. I had a question.
No, go for it.
Do you think data availability will be the largest use case for AVS? If not, what else do you think like could take it? Or are there other ones that are going to be big too? Like, what do you say? What do you think will be the biggest use cases for AVSs?
Well, I want to have Chanda also answer this.
I'll share as well too. You can start though.
Yeah, I know. So I think like even though I don't know what will consume this co-processing type of stuff, and I'm not saying the co-processing that's like, oh, I ran a language model for you. I mean, like it could be a much simpler model. It could be much lower capacity, but something that just like sucks on the blockchain to execute. Like, I think like that type of stuff to me is super interesting. Now, the question is like, does it need ZK or not? That will kind of, that's going to be the harder part to determine. Like, obviously the ZK stuff is like necessary for these really high value things, which are like closer to DeFi. But then these like applications that are like less high value, like Frentech or Farcaster or something, per interaction. Sorry, I'm not saying the network. I'm just saying like on a per interaction. Yeah. On a per interaction basis, they're kind of lower value. I think those ones, I don't think there's a reason for them to pay for ZK. It's like way too expensive on a, you know, and I don't know how much the extra premium of that security matters. So there's gonna be a spectrum of those. I don't think it's gonna be this like AI on the blockchain stuff, which is just a meme. But I do think there's a lot of like lots of expensive calculations that people do off chain right now that could be done in a co-processing manner and will be done on chain. Now, you know, obviously, I think there's a ton of places where people are like, oh, we could just replace something someone's doing right now. And it's a little less clear because I do think the MEV type of stuff is also quite large in this world. And like that is the hidden cost to these types of things. But I just generally I think I like the co-processors. Again, I'm not so sure on the ZK side. I definitely feel like the more economically the ones that are like objectively slashable. Where like, hey, maybe, you know, the coprocessor gives the wrong answer, someone recomputes it later and then generates a ZK proof as a fallback. So like, I've always thought that like, you could have an optimistic coprocessor and then a ZK fallback or a TE fallback, a trusted execution enclave, where like, you have this optimistic thing, people stake, and then to get slash, someone has to generate a proof that they ran the same code, but they ran in ZK or TE, and they generate a proof that shows you got the wrong answer. And then when you get slash, they get some of that slash, right? So
we have a very similar framework at IAM to the way we think about querying validator balances. It's like you preempt it with centralized sources to query like validator balances, and then you can, in the occurrence or the event of a slashing, you can report, run the ZK proof, and then liquidate. And it's this kind of same idea of like optimistically agree with something and then trustlessly verify if you actually need to pursue the like, or kind of punish the aberrant action.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think like this optimistic and then ZK after type of thing is like literally the best middle ground. I think like the pure ZK is really expensive, and the pure optimistic is like, well, okay, then might as well just be totally centralized at that point. So it's like, I think there's kind of this middle ground, and I think like because there's so many teams working on either side of that, they will converge to the middle.
Yeah.
So.
No, I totally agree. I like, so my, one of the things, like my North Stars on kind of thinking about AVSs, because I think there's an interesting question that you asked, Dave, which is like, what are the biggest or most important AVSs? I think the way you answered it, Tarun, is like, what are the AVSs that could directly justify the kind of like the cost of capital required to like secure their systems? Which is less than saying like which AVS will have like the biggest market cap. I think that's a very interesting way to frame the question. I totally agree with that, because the cost of, or for the coprocessor side, because the cost of compute that you're saving can directly be translated, like some spread of that can be directly translated to value that you share with like the restaker, right? Or the person who's providing that security. I, to a certain extent, think of this the same way for one of the use cases that I'm really interested in, which is this idea of like, cross-chain settlement, chain abstraction, bridging. I think this idea of, like, right now we have two different types of kind of philosophy around security for bridging. So one is the traditional, like, you stake some capital to secure a bridge, the nodes get slashed if they ever kind of perform an aberrant action or, you know, say falsify the data that's being passed through the bridge contract. And then you have this other model, which is, okay, let's, this is the intent-based model, which is like, okay, let's outsource the risk to someone else who takes on that risk, that reorg or that falsification risk. And then, you know, they get compensated in order for taking on that risk. And even in the traditional like chain setting, like you still have to pay out validators. So they still kind of get some form of payment. I think there's some kind of convergence here with both of those systems where you're effectively at the end of the day paying for security slash insurance from some counterparty. And there's a cost there. And that cost inherently has value because you're transferring value from one place to another. And I think it, to me, it's one of the most like economically sound reasons to use restaking, because inherently the transfer value and the inheritance of the infrastructure risk or the network risk by some counterparty, whether it's a validator or whether it's someone putting up some kind of collateral, justifies like the cost and use of specifically shared security, as well as just like generally security, security just by restaked assets. And it, this one, this is, I'd say, runs the kind of middle ground of being intersubjective and perfectly objective, depending on what kind of messaging that you're transferring cross chain and then the verification framework you're using. So I'd say that's the thing I'm most bullish on. The thing I'm most bullish on for intersubjective slashing in particular is deepened systems and like watchtower networks. This is another thing where it's a lot harder to price the value of watchtower networks and of like verification of services rendered. But basically, if you have a deepened system and you have some kind of commodity floating around where it's like it's internet bandwidth or it's like cell service or whatever, there is inherent value in being able to verify that someone is providing that service or that resource and how much in a consistent manner, up to the, you know, agreement that they kind of outlined with the end user or the end kind of receiver of that resource. And then people who actually verify that being the case and ensure against that not being the case has inherent value as well. And it's also very, sometimes could be very intersubjective, or at least it could be very difficult to verify the status and state of these different types of resources floating around on chain. So I'd say those are two things that I find really, really interesting from a personal standpoint.
Yeah. So I have another question going off of that. So right now there's $16 billion in TVL in EigenLayer. That's a lot of TVL. Do you think that's the supply? Do you think there's enough demand in AVSs right now to, get a solid yield for that $16 billion? What do you expect the yield to be kicking off when that whole system starts and whatnot?
Yeah, look, that yield is not going, if you're expecting 10% or whatever, I don't know what to tell you. That's Ethereum fees level, right? I'm not trying to, or at least, close. I think it's more likely that obviously the $15 billion is going to have to be subsidized. So subsidies are going to come from a lot of places. Obviously one subsidy is, the AVSs themselves will likely have tokens and pay incentives. Two, I guess the LRTs will also have tokens. There's obviously going to be some incentives, spent to try to make up that difference. Will those incentives be $150 million worth per year? That's not clear, but I wouldn't be surprised if it gets close. I think the better question to ask is in 5 years, will the AVSs be able to support a 3-5% yield on what's there? And I guess my argument is that, there is a thing to remember, which I think people kind of forget, which is, why did people to some extent rush into restaking? I mean, there's a lot of very ETH rich people I've talked to who are I don't even know why I put, X $100 million in. It just sounded like putting into Lido early. I think there's kind of some truth to it, which is hey, actually for a lot of people, they're still getting their staking yield. And so anything extra is gravy. And if there's no slashing right now, what's the difference to that? You know what I mean? They maybe will be unhappy with some airdrop for a little bit, but they're still probably getting excess yield that was relatively risk-free compared to the other things I could have done. So I feel like there's a little bit, that's where I find the people whining on the internet a little insufferable. I'm sure it's not, if you lost principal, sure, but come on.
Yeah.
The way I view, I guess, the fees in the long run is if we take the set of roll-up fees right now, imagine in a world where all decentralized sequencing and shared sequencing is somehow done via something that looks like restaking. The question is, if I add up all the fees of all the rollups right now and I multiply by some multiplier for how those fees are going to grow over time, I'm just to give some comparison, right now Optimism is doing $65K a day in fees. Arbitrum is doing $30K a day in fees. $30K a day in fees is 15, let's call it 15-ish million, 15, 16 million. For Optimism, that's 23 million. So if we, those are the top two rollups, right? After that, it goes down. Polygon's in a similar category to Arbitrum. So that's around 50 million in fees. Let's say we multiply that by three, that's 150 million. And let's say that the restakers take half for running the sequencer. that's pretty good, right? That's like $75 million in fees. Now, obviously, this is assuming some concentration effect. Question.
Is this fees or is this actually a take home? Is this split?
No, I'm talking about just fees. I'm ignoring incentives. I'm talking about like real fees on rollups. And, you know, right now, those fees, a lot of them are going to Sequencer. I mean, Sequencer does have to post to mainnet, so it's not like it's totally free. But the idea is just like, I mean, blobs are really cheap right now, so I feel like you might as well count the fees, right? At least for now. Yeah. But you know, I'm just trying to get some back of the envelope numbers from like real fees that are made, right? So like 3x the usage on rollups doesn't seem that crazy, especially with all these new rollups. Like, and so yeah, like if say like most of the decentralized sequencing and shared sequencing is done in restaking like systems. And 50% of the revenue goes to them. The other 50% to like whatever burns and token the L2 token somehow. Then that's $75 million in fees, right? $75 million. There you go. That's 5%. So I'm just trying to give you like some back of the envelope numbers for what it would take. And it doesn't seem that crazy if you can get the roll up market. And then after that, it's all these new markets, right? And the new markets you have to predict some growth rate for.
So I would say that's not percent, sure. Right. 5%.
Sorry, 15 billion, so 1% is 150 million, so 0.5%. So you're getting 0.5% yield from rollups. So the question is like how are the other places kind of that'll generate yield. And the question is like, is there anything else that you can think of? That's the part that I still can't.
That's the hard part.
Figure out. Like, will these co-processors generate that much? I feel like the co-processors are kind of closer to DeFi protocols than they are like in terms of fee generation than rollups, which means that they'll be like very spiky. They'll like generate no money most of the time. And then every once in a while, there'll be like some big event, like huge market crash. Or something,
like a DPEG or something. I just think a curve.
Yeah, something like that is like always the biggest fee generation day, right? So it's like I kind of feel like co-processors will look like that, unless like rollups are more consistent. So, long story short, I don't know if they're going to get to like 10%, but you know, getting to like 3-4% doesn't seem so crazy. So, like, the question is, can the subsidies survive until that point? To make it to that.
Yeah. I want to shift the conversation a bit to Bitcoin, because right now we're seeing, you know, Bitcoin staking, whether it's like Botanix or Bitcoin restaking with Babylon coming online. And I listened to an interview with Wart, and you were talking about how with proof of stake, there's basically this opportunity cost of should I stake or should I go into lending markets? And there's this kind of game theory at play. So what do you think that like Bitcoin staking or Bitcoin and Bitcoin restaking is going to do to Bitcoin? Like what kind of challenges, I suppose, what kind of game theory will be at play? What are your thoughts on the ramifications of all that?
Yeah, the problem with Bitcoin staking to me in a lot of ways is like, it's a little bit like the bridges from Bitcoin argument. It's like very hard to do like a real bridge per se. You really are kind of doing a side chain, so it's like the restaking stuff feels like that. I mean, there are ZK bridge protocols that people are making, which are like many rounds, so like will be slow on Bitcoin, so it might take you like 4 hours to bridge on and off, maybe more, but you can be sure that you're actually bridging, so versus the side chain. So I think the security model is also very different, first off. And so it's like hard to compare. And secondly, I just don't know, like, you know, if you look at Bitcoin side chains like Stax and whatever, ignore their marketing. Like there really is still not quite, it's like basically sidechain plus plus. They're still never getting that much organic demand. There's like way more demand in like ordinals and runes and like the like metadata trading than there is in this like sidechain stuff. So it doesn't make me particularly bullish on the Bitcoin staking. I just feel like culturally the people there don't want to do that. and I don't know if you're going to convince them. Like, they've had all these opportunities forever with like every possible Bitcoin derivative that's existed. So
yeah,
I'm not so bullish on it, to be honest, for that reason. Now, I could be totally wrong, like, but I'm, it's not a high confidence I'm not bullish. Like, I just am not convinced these Bitcoin whales are willing to do that. You know, it's like that. That's the thing.
If they would have done it, they would have done it by now.
Yeah, I feel like they've had so many opportunities, and it just like makes me feel like it's not true. But I feel like I've talked to some Bitcoin whales about Bitcoin restaking, and they're like, "Oh, this sounds fake," you know. And I'm like, "Okay, well, you know."
Does that mean you're bearish Bitcoin L2s, or what are your thoughts on Bitcoin L2s?
I mean, again, they're like, I prefer to think of those as like centralized exchanges that happen to do slightly better settlement to Bitcoin. They're centralized exchanges in that like their L2 is like pseudo centralized, and you're trusting their bridge, their on and off contract. And it's just kind of not really a L2 in the normal sense. Like, they're not even like trying to have like a withdrawal mechanism that isn't like centralized in some ways. So other than the ZK ones are different, but I truly mean actually like the ones like Merlin,
like Alpen, right?
The ones
Merlin,
tons of TVL. Yeah, like Alpen is very like, you know, they're very principled and they're gonna make it like
they're
gonna make it work. But then again, you see things like Merlin get like 5 billion TVL and you're like, okay, well, clearly the Bitcoin whales in Asia have a very different view of like what counts as an L2, right? And even in Dubai, I was in Dubai, I took a hike around. Like, people were just like talking about Bitcoin L2s, but then I asked them, I was like, okay, well, an L2 usually has to have some withdrawal hatch mechanism for you to take your funds off. You know, like, have you thought about that? And then they're like, no, it's just something where I send to this Bitcoin address and then all of a sudden I get some Bitcoin on this other wallet and then I use it and buy an NFT. I'm like, okay, so it's definitely still a sidechain, because like you look at the code bases, it's like they're not really L2s. And then someone told me like, oh, well, that's because that you Westerners are using L2 only for this one thing, but it could mean many things. And I'm like, okay,
no,
well,
it means this thing.
So I was just like, all right, you know what, I think I've just kind of been like, all right, so it's like hard for me to get excited other than like the Alpens of the world, because they're like those are actually real, but then the usage are all on the ones that are not.
Yeah. So. In Dubai, I know it was like a few weeks ago at this point, other than like the floods and shit, did you have any like valuable takeaways or anything, any astute observations, anything like pop out at you, you know, being in Dubai?
I feel like I feel like I more viscerally understand why Solana is so much more successful than most other L1s.
Why is that?
What about Dubai made you realize that? I'm curious.
Yeah.
What about Dubai in particular? Out of everywhere else in the world.
Okay, this is a very dumb observation, and I hope I don't get roasted for this. But I just find, I first of all, I'm not an NFT person. I don't really like NFTs. But I find Solana NFTs, I actually really think like Solana protocols have done an amazing job. They actually care about their users. They've like really built really cool stuff. But I just find the art in Solana NFTs very mid, personally. Like, I just don't like, I've never liked any of the art in any Solana NFT, personally. It's just personal. And there are people who've like skinned their cars in Solana NFT. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, whoa, this is crazy. Like, I saw like a Porsche or something with like some like whatever the Solana monkey on it. And I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you also mentioned before that not with Solana DAOs, you know, there's high participation there. They're doing a lot of things right. I guess what's going on Solana, whether it's with the DAOs or, you know, with the protocols and with the culture that's gaining this positive momentum. Yeah.
I think they treat the DAOs like DAO part, like a lot of protocol teams treat DAOs as, customers also, and like users, and so they like try to have a good user experience on like even the most basic things like community calls. there's a lot of protocols you get at community calls, and it's like, so this week we submitted PR number 69, which changes this CI file, and now we're running a test for this that clears up audit 320 findings. But I think there's a lot of, like, in the Solana world, they actually try to make it fun. It's like even for, like, DeFi protocols, it's a different game. So I think that's one thing I really like, that I've seen. They just, like, have a lot more energy and enthusiasm in that way. And I think obviously it, you know, they've gone through a lot, and I think that camaraderie has made them, like, make a better kind of, so they've done a totally different thing. Yeah. Obviously Ethereum's still the king. I think, like, there's a world in which, you know, if all of these types of things that Chanda was talking about, like the interop stuff and aggregation stuff, I think in the current meta, there's, in my mind, there's really sort of like four ecosystems. Ecosystem one is Solana. Or sorry, five ecosystems. Ecosystem one is Solana. Ecosystem two is probably Near, Sui, and Aptos, and all L1s after that, probably in that order.
Mm-hmm.
Ecosystem three is AVSs. I'm sorry, these are not ranked. These are just, like, I'm saying, like, the I'm just categorizing them. Like, it's sort of like clustering the ecosystem. Solana gets its own, though. That's the difference between Solana. The other L1s are kind of together. Solana really gets its own.
Mm-hmm.
Ecosystem four is the aggregation layer stuff, which I think there's, it's not just Polygon. I mean, Polygon certainly created the meme around it, but I think there's a lot of teams working on things around this idea of doing aggregation, which is sort of, in my mind, the end game of a lot of this cross-chain interop stuff. But yeah, you know, we actually have to get it working and whatever. But, like, if it does work, then, like, maybe the liquidity issues become moot, and you, Ethereum UX can go back to being like Solana. And then the final ecosystem is just, like, the L3 roll-up world, which I don't know how to think about it right now. It's obviously growing, but it's, like, kind of, yeah, it's a sort of different beast than the other ones.
Why specifically I feel like L3?
Oh, I'm counting L2s. I mean, L3s and L2s, but, like, okay. I guess the thing that people are always hyping as things launching on L2s nowadays are not protocols, but L3s on my L2.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I got it. You know, speaking of things that are launching, SHIB announced recently that they're launching a fully homomorphic.
Wow, those dog coins are such assholes.
Sorry. It's been a long day.
Homomorphic, fully homomorphic encryption.
I'm going to get roasted for that. Yeah, they're launching that blockchain, which I find interesting that meme coins are now launching, they're going into this space. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, as an investor in a lot of FHE stuff, I'm obviously happy to see more, to be honest, because FHE is the thing that, like, really got me into reading crypto papers when I was in college, because, like, that was when it came, like, Gentry's thesis came out in 2010 or something. And I remember I, like, read that, and that was the thing that made me go, like, wow, this is actually crazy that this shit even works at all. I think it is obviously the final boss. It's not investing in that stuff is not like investing in, you know, DeFi protocol or L1, right? It's definitely going to take a lot longer. But I think FHE and ZK combined just, like, have the ability to make so much stuff way more efficient.
What do you think the timeline is for encryption nirvana?
Encryption Nirvana.
Encryption Nirvana, yeah.
So, like, I think I've softened my stance over time on TEs. I think, like, if you want to have encryption nirvana today, just use a TE as to get an idea for, like, what the UX you want is. Maybe not the developer UX. The developer side could be a lot better, but the user UX. And so I think, like, I think FHE is not tomorrow. It's, you know, I think the FHE roll-ups like Phoenix and Inco, they will definitely be able to launch and do a lot of cool stuff. But there's a sense in which a lot of them are acting to some extent as like FHE co-processors that do small computation bundled with a public roll-up. Because like you in some ways you don't want to do everything totally in FHE. You do want things like the supply of the blockchain to be public, because inevitably blockchains are actually, like most human things, have some public state and some private state, and you need to have a separation. And you know, people won't use things if it's fully private in some ways, as we've seen with privacy chains. Like, and the other thing is DeFi doesn't work in a fully private world, right? Like, if I tell you there's an AMM, but it's not telling me the price or the slippage when I make a trade, like, why would I use AMM, right? Like, finance inherently needs public data. Like, inherently needs some amount of public data and some amount of private data that creates the public data. And you have to have both. And so I think the way their FHE rollups are thinking about it, at least, sorry, I should specialize to, like, I know a lot about Phoenix Inco and I have no clue about SHIB, but I, you know, I heard Zama talking about it a bunch. So I have no clue what to make of SHIB's rollup. I'm not sure why they need FHE, but whereas I do think there's a lot of like on-chain gaming and gambling stuff that actually does a lot better with FHE. I think, you know, the reason the stake.coms of the world are not fully on-chain is like most gambling experiments on-chain have been manipulated severely, and FHE is actually very useful for guaranteeing a lot of randomness properties.
Yeah, I remember early on in crypto, because at my first job I was in EOS land, and like the biggest dApp on EOS was like EOS Bet.
Yeah, and then Tron copied it. Do you remember Tron Bet? Like literally.
Yeah, and then Tron Bet, and this thing would rake in money, and it was addicting.
But then
too.
People would always find some bug in the random number generator, and then just like own the contracts.
So that's
where the FHE part is actually very good. It's like very good at doing kind of like privatized VRFs, like really getting better privacy guarantees on the VRFs.
Yeah. And also, speaking of meme coins, how long do you think this, you know, meme coin cycle will last? Do you think meme coins have become a viable asset class for people to invest in? Or do you think like this is going to fade away? It's funny to think that like the participants, I was reading something today that, retail isn't here. Everybody here is like, has been around. So we've all kind of collectively decided to like ape into meme coins and make them a viable asset class. I'm not talking about us in particular, but just like crypto and CT as a whole. So, but what are your thoughts on meme coins and them staying around?
I'm not as nihilistic about it. I actually think they're like a funny thing to exist. I think there's something very funny about the fact that like every time there's like some major event, like people will start making a bunch of meme coins about the event. Like, you know, when the bridge collapsed in Maryland.
I saw that, yeah.
There are like a million meme coins. And like, then you go look an hour later and it's like, oh, there's only two of them that have a ton of liquidity. I kind of like this idea of meme coins as people voting on social events. I don't know. People want to gamble and it's like, that's it. I don't know what to say other than that.
Yeah, I think it was like a inefficient, a halfway point between like an inefficient representation of prediction markets and
like unbounded, you know, prediction markets that you can't resolve.
And then like an IRL attention, or like an actual, like an actually transparently priced attention economy. I think there's something there, but it's
definitely
very
something there.
Disorganized.
I don't know how to productize that.
I think like, they work better than prediction markets, because in prediction markets you're kind of limited. You know, there's only like so many like yeses or nos, or like, I think this event or that event's going to happen. With like a meme coin for a certain event, let's say like a presidential election, I can go buy like Bowdoin, and the upside is, you know, infinite, but also the downside's infinite. With prediction markets, it's like there's only, it's an order book, so there's only so many yeses and nos.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's kind of interesting, but yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like I don't know if I feel like the nihilism part, I think, was a little overblown.
Overblown, over, same. Yeah, they're fun and they get people excited.
What was the saying? If you give a man a slot machine, he'll learn to lose his money. But if you give a man a meme coin, he'll learn to gamble forever.
Where? Who quoted that one?
I don't know. I saw that on somewhere online. I don't remember, but it's
like, I'm gonna need someone to find. Because
like the meme coin never goes to zero, technically.
Technically, true.
There's always there's always hope. Unlike the slot machine. Slot machine takes your money and bye bye.
Another thing I want to move to is, you know, since you work in risk, you know, possible black swan events this cycle. What do you think, you know, people should be looking at, you know, that no one's really talking about yet? I mean, like last cycle we had like Luna, you know, this cycle people are talking about other things. You know, what do you think like people should be wary of or like have like caution towards?
I think obviously the idea that certain assets are pegged and then people taking leverage on those assets thinking they're pegged is always the source of things blowing up. So abstractly that
I like how you worded that.
There are a couple places that applies.
Yeah.
There are many places that applies. In fact, like a lot of like cross-chain stuff that also applies.
I mean, like bridges and stuff. True. Oh, that's true. Yeah. Chuda, you know that all too well.
Yes.
So I think like that's obviously the place. Like, don't take 100x leverage on something that's already a derivative. look, I'm not trying to tell you what to do with your money. If you want to do it, do it. I'm just saying I wouldn't do it. Sorry. <Yeah. I> should.
Fair. And moving on a bit, getting a bit lighter here. Where did your obsession for sugar-free Red Bull came from, and how'd you get them to send you free shit?
It's a great question. I feel like it was in high school. I just like started drinking it, or in college. Oh, well, we lost Chino. But started drinking it because I always just like had to stay up late, and I was like a late night person. But I had school at like some fucking horrible hour, like 7:30 or whatever. Because like, I don't understand why they make people go to high school.
I don't know.
Yeah,
it's like so ridiculous.
Kids waking up at 7:30.
You think they would let the kids sleep?
I know. It's like, come on. But and basically like, I would always like keep falling asleep in class in high school, and like. Yeah. The only thing I could easily always have and like quickly chug was Red Bull, like energy drink. So then I just like had one all the time. and then it just
became a meme.
It just became a thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, it's just so efficient compared to coffee, right? It's like, oh, it's cold. It's ready. It's like, you can have it whenever you want. And I think I just got so used to the taste that like, I can't drink the sugared one at all. Sugared one tastes so weird to me. And I've never liked all the other energy drinks. I find a little too weird.
A few moments later.
Yeah, so I was going to say, your Red Bull obsession reminds me of my like Arizona obsession. Because I'm thinking like, a real stable coin. Well, yeah, with Arizona, that kind of happened quite naturally because I just wear like, shirts like all kinds of.
Actually, yeah, that's right. Your shirt looks like it's Arizona.
This is actually from the Arizona website. Arizona makes very high quality clothes and merch.
Wait, really?
Yeah, go to their website. They have like sick jackets. They have puffer jackets.
Might have to cop one.
Yeah, and like for me, like whenever I went to conferences, people would recognize me for my Arizona shirt, and so then I'm just like, I'm gonna commit to the bit, and then I just like, and then I did, and got the tattoo, got just wear, changed my whole wardrobe to cherry blossoms, and I'm still running with it, and I'm hoping they sponsor me one day. Or like send me like Arizona, like they sent you Red Bull.
That's I believe awesome. It.
Did you I have a did you have a connect at Red Bull, or how did that happen?
So I guess like because I was doing Chopping Block, there was just like a lot of people who listened to it, and some woman who listened to it, or no, sorry, this guy who listened to it. Was a woman? I forget that this person who listened to Chopping Block said their cousin works at Red Bull. Mm-hmm. And they sponsor this type of stuff all the time, and they just emailed and they're like, what's your address? And so that was it. Oh, wow. That was, yeah. it was real. I mean, look, maybe you, now that you host this podcast, Arizona is going to be like hitting you up like, yo, we're going to send you free Arizona, but you got to shill it.
Yeah. If any of my listeners, you know somebody or have a family member that works in Arizona, feel free to hit my line. I was going to also say the Chopping Block is like one of the few podcasts I listen to on a consistent basis. I just like people that work in the industry that have a podcast that's kind of like their side thing. It's like, oh, like, and they can just share all their observations at once.
Yeah. You know, it's like, it was funny. One very funny fact observation about it is I think we had like everyone who went to jail in the last cycle on that podcast. We had Doe, we had SBF. I think we had Kyle, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, all right, well, no, it was just kind of funny that we like interviewed all these people and then like a year later they're on the run.
Yeah. Oh, wait, did you get CZ though?
No, we didn't get to.
Oh,
shit. That's true.
So with the
he has time while he's in jail.
Maybe. So with the all-in comparison, who's Chamath? Who's Jason?
I hate all-in. Personally, like I just find the people on it like obnoxious.
Yeah.
I would hope that I'm Friedberg because he's the least obnoxious, but you know.
Fair.
Who's Chamath? I don't know.
Who's Jason? Haseeb
could either be Jason or Chamath. He's like a hybrid of the two.
Yeah, that's true. And who's Dave?
I don't know who else. Like, the problem is Chamath likes getting Sax likes getting in fights, but I'm like, who the fuck is fighting on their show? It's just me and Haseeb, probably.
You're all just hybrids of each of the guys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Although I'd prefer to just stay Friedberg.
Stay away. all right, we're going to wrap this up, but before we go, we like to do a lightning round to get to know our guests a little bit better off-chain. So just three questions. The first question is, you know, when did you first touch the chain and sex doesn't count?
2012, 2013, Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I also had some Prime Coin. I was mining Prime Coin.
Oh.
And then, what is the name of that defunct chain that I, there's some other chain I was mining. I forgot, but yeah, it was like those. I think I had some Kanye West.
Kanye.
Nice.
But like, I have no clue where the fuck that wallet is. I once was trying to look just for the lols and I like couldn't find it. And I have a feeling it was like on some laptop that I recycled. So bye bye, Kanye. Real burn. Yeah. The best part about all these old chains is that they all had inherent burn mechanisms of people fucking losing their ability to get wallet.dat to work.
Burn built in.
Built in burn.
What would be some advice to your younger self?
Don't sell all the Bitcoin that I
mine. No, you can't do that. 2013.
That one's fucking easy. Like,
Well, that's why we say don't do that answer.
You only said that after I gave an answer, buddy.
Other than that one, what would be, you know, advice to your younger self?
probably finish this fucking album I once was making that I never finished.
You had an album?
I used to produce techno. So I like if I could just stop working and like I would go do that.
For, my old roommate, God bless him, when in 2019 when we were stopped living together, he was like, I'm gonna work on an album. He's a musician. Like makes all kinds of like EDM, hip hop, like kind of hippie sabotage, hybrid kind of stuff. And he worked on this album for 4 years. Like he was such a perfectionist. I remember like we were living in Brazil. He was working on it there. Like all throughout COVID, he was working on it. And like he finally pushed through and finished it after 4 years. So shout out Arnik. He's the only Arnik. So if you just Google Arnik and you can find his videos. But yeah, you should finish that. You should go push through.
When did you start it? How long ago was it?
Yeah.
2013.
You should finish it and then throw a party and play it.
The thing is, all the tracks ever released, I did kind of like Anon-ish, so it was kind of like, you know, I continued doing it. And like I actually really like the aspect of kind of like some of the parts of electronic music that I listen to, which is there's a lot of like Anon artists who like don't, and like that's kind of that's my jam.
And final question, who would you recommend as a guest? Who would you want to see on the show?
Gort.
Oh, I had him. I had him on.
Well, all right. Well, then, a Balloon Lover.
Who's that?
Oh, Xerox really? Balloon Lover.
That's an interesting one. He's one of the Anons.
Is he Venture Apologist?
Yes.
Oh, he's so funny. I would love to get him on. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a good one.
I feel like that's got to be up there.
Yeah. Tarun, thanks for so much for going on. Where can people find you if they want to follow you?
Tarun Chitra on Twitter. Probably that's the easiest place. I'm on Farcaster too. But like honestly, mainly tweet. Sometimes use Farcaster. I feel like Farcaster is the type of thing where it's like goes in waves. Sometimes it's good. Yeah. Sometimes it's like very the content stale. It's like I've never been able to like consistently keep using it.
Yeah, I feel that.
I feel like that's what everyone like runs into, and so you don't ever have consistent content.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's like taken off more than other things, like Blue Sky. Like, when the fuck is the last time I opened that? Like once. Yeah. Like, but it hasn't quite stuck. It's like still missing something.
Yeah. No, I feel that. But Tarun, thanks so much for coming on. Hope to see you again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thanks. Everything said in this episode is not financial or tax advice. This channel is strictly for educational purposes and is not an investment advice or solicitation to buy or sell any assets or to make any financial decisions. This video is not tax advice whatsoever. Please talk to your accountant and do your own research.